Forgiveness is not the dewdrops of God's graceful blessing that come down and are part of song and creed and sweet things that we say to one another. Forgiveness is a power. Forgiveness is perhaps the most tangible and concrete way in which those of us who are Christians realize and begin to walk in the power of Jesus Christ. The power that he gives is not sheer raw power. It's power given through his forgiveness to transform us so that we see ourselves as people who are forgiven and who go in peace. Now, that's what I want us to talk about for the next few moments. How do we grasp that forgiveness? How does it become more than the dewdrops of heaven sweetly coming down, enshrined in poem and song and meaning absolutely nothing? How is this forgiveness to be understood as a power that truly works to transform our hearts? You know, Jesus was not picky about who he ate with. That's one of the things that you see in this story. The invitation came from Simon, a Pharisee. And it's not remarkable that Simon invited him. Apparently, Simon was curious. This is almost certainly Capernaum. Simon had seen, along with many others, the miracles that Jesus had done or apparently done by the seashore. He was curious. He wanted to find out what was going on. So he invites Jesus over for supper. It's not remarkable that Jesus was there. And it's not remarkable that others were there. You may think of it, when you read this story, let it shock you just a little bit. I mean, in walks a woman. She wasn't invited. She wasn't on the guest list. Actually, that was not very unusual in those days. All kinds of people would show up at the dinner parties that were given by prominent people in the community. It was part of the custom of the time that people would be allowed and permitted to come in. They would stand around the edges of the dining room waiting for scraps of food and scraps of conversation to take away from the time. What is not remarkable is that Jesus was there, and what is not remarkable is that there other people were there. What is remarkable is that this woman was there. And the remarkable nature of it is shown in the opening words that are said about her. And behold, behold who's here. Look who is at the dining table unexpectedly. No doubt some of the guests around that dining table recognized her. No doubt most of the ones who recognized her were men. It's fair to say that they were her customers. Now, just a parenthesis for clarity. Some of you think what I thought for about 20 years of my Christian life, that this is Mary Magdalene. It's not. First of all, it doesn't say so in the text. And secondly, there is no indication anywhere in the New Testament that Mary Magdalene was a woman with a bad reputation or had done anything to earn a bad reputation. This is a nameless woman. We don't know who she is. What is remarkable is that she recognizes Jesus. She no doubt recognizes Jesus because she too, as a citizen of Capernaum, if that's indeed where this is, had seen him performing miracles around the seaside. And perhaps she had attended some of his morning Bible studies, and it appears that she had come to understand the grace of the gospel from his lips. In other words, she had come to understand the forgiveness that was indeed given to her. And this is a table. It's a low-lying table where people would eat. And as the custom of the time, you would sort of lean into the table and your feet would be splayed out behind you. And this provided the access for this woman to the feet of Jesus as she would come in, and she was surprised by something she saw. That Simon had not provided for the courtesies of the day, apparently, in the case of Jesus. Because the courtesies of the day would have meant that he would have hired a servant who would have been at the door, who would have washed the feet from the dusty roads as the people came in. Similarly to the way you would offer the opportunity for a guest in your home to go wash up in the powder room, perhaps, before they would sit down to eat. Now, what follows indicates that this woman recognizes Jesus, but most significantly, she doesn't recognize just who he is. She recognizes what he gives. And she understands that he has given to her forgiveness. And she becomes the illustration of the kind of person we're talking about here who knows that forgiveness is a transforming power. For her life is the very evidence of that transforming power. Let's see how, under the three headings that I suggested to you in the bulletin. The purifying power of forgiveness belongs to this woman. The irony of forgiveness is evident in this situation. Or you might call it the perplexity of forgiveness that is evident in this situation. And then there is the passion of forgiveness, which leads to certain actions. First, the purifying power of forgiveness is revealed in the woman's response to the situation, and especially to Jesus. Now, I want you to notice that in all the things that are described here under those four letters, A, B, and C, and D, that they are all physical things. The response is outward and physical, but these outward and physical responses become the clue to what? The inward and invisible change that has gone on in this woman's life. Inward and invisible change manifested in outward ways, first by tears. The woman came in, she did not expect what happened. She, in all certainty, did not expect that she would, upon the sight of the one who had given her forgiveness, begin to weep. But is it not true that forgiveness melts our cold pride? And that weeping is actually a very understandable physical response to the inward heart's change. Second, the hair. The woman sees herself as unworthy of Jesus. She fears that her tears, now that have fallen on his feet, will defile him, because she knows what kind of person she is. So she immediately does what no woman would ever do in public. She lets down her hair and begins to wipe away the tears with her feet, unwittingly making up for Simon's lack to provide the servant at the door who wipes away the feet from Jesus' feet. Letting down her hair in public would have been one of those things that would have caused a collective gasp in the room. Why? Because women did not let their hair down in public in these days. The only time a woman would let her hair down would be in the safety and comfort and intimacy of being with her loved ones in her own home. And the only other time a woman would let her hair down in the presence of another person would be when that woman was going to enter into a physical relationship with that man that was illicit. She would let her hair down. And because there are many men in this room who recognize this woman as friends of hers, they gasp when she lets her hair down. Third, kisses. She kissed his feet. What's that? Well, even the way we would say that today indicates that it's a sign of the deepest respect and willingness to serve. No one, you know, in the ancient world was required to touch another person's feet. Even the lowest servant of the household would not be required to clean the feet at the door. They'd hire an outside servant for that purpose. To touch the feet of someone was to indicate in the most radical way that you were putting yourself under them, in subservience to them, that you were willing to serve them, that you were going to serve them. There was nothing you were holding back any longer. Nothing. Because you were willing to touch their feet. And then the perfume is the fourth thing. The woman recognizes, apparently, Simon's failure to provide the soap and water at the door, so she compensates by this perfume that she brought, perhaps intending to honor Jesus with just giving him a little bit of it. Now she pours it out, and as I've said in a different context not too long ago, this undoubtedly represented the wealth of this woman. Whatever it was, the money she had earned from her professional life, she had probably put into this ointment as a kind of way of preserving it. And now she pours it all out in an expression of unfeigned generosity to the one who has so deeply forgiven her. Tears, hair, kisses, perfume. Now, I'm going to use a word here that you might be surprised that I'm about ready to use. At least some of you, those of you who are solid in being your good Orthodox Protestant selves. These things you might call sacramental. I don't mean that they're sacraments in the same way that baptism or the Lord's Supper is a sacrament, but they're sacramental in the sense that a sacrament is a visible and physical outward sign of an inward and invisible reality. And all of these things, all of them, the tears, the hair, the kisses, and the perfume, are outward and visible signs of the inward change that has gone on in this woman's life to display how changed, how moved, how different she is, and to demonstrate the purifying power of forgiveness that is displayed in her life. Second, the perplexity of forgiveness. There's the purifying power of forgiveness, and then there's what I call its perplexity, or you might say its irony. The scene is full of ironic contrast. The smugness of Simon, his cool aloofness, his critical spirit. I mean, he is just being critical at everybody around him, isn't he? He's critical of the woman. He's critical of Jesus. Nobody can get it right. He is a Pharisee, and he's living up to his name. Contrast that with the unfeigned worship of the woman. She doesn't care who sees her. She doesn't care who sees her letting down her hair and weeping. She will do anything because she has received so much. So now she is prepared to demonstrate outwardly the inward change that has taken place in her life. Simon, the religious precisionist, the legalist, do it right, do it good, look good, say the right thing. I call it the Nike approach to the Christian life. Right? Just do it. And the woman? Well, there's no illusions for her. She doesn't look good, at least not morally. She hasn't done it right. And she and everybody else knows it. And you know what? She doesn't care any longer who knows it. What a contrast. You see, the perplexity, the irony of the passage is what is so evident here. And it's demonstrated in what the woman and Simon receive from this encounter, this situation. What does the woman receive? What does she take away? She who has nothing receives everything. Out of her failure, morally speaking, she gains everything. Everything because of her realization of the power of the forgiveness that has been given to her and the power of that forgiveness to transform her inwardly. She demonstrates the change in her by her outward behavior. But the change itself is a radically inward one. Contrast her with Simon. For her, for the woman, everything is inward first and outward second. For Simon, it's outward first and it never gets inward. For Simon, he has everything. Position, recognition, wealth. But what does he receive? Nothing. Position, recognition, and wealth are really signs in this case of what? His inward poverty. He simply doesn't get it, does he? He doesn't understand. He's just upset that Jesus is breaking the religious rules. If this man were a prophet, he would know what sort of woman it is who is touching him. And Jesus, in response, has a story for Simon. And what is the essence of the story? Two people owe money to a moneylender. One owns 50 denarii, one owes 500. The moneylender forgives both. Which one, Jesus says, is going to love him more? Well, Simon says, rationally and correctly, the one who was forgiven the greater debt. So what is this story all about? It's about comparative forgiveness. And the passage reeks with irony. You see, the forgiveness forces a contrast. Like when a bright light comes into the room and you've been in darkness, what do? You open your eyes and you see the things around you by that light. But the light may hurt your eyes at first and pierce. And you may have the temptation to close your eyes and to shut out the light. And that's the difference between these two people. The light is shining in this dining room, and the woman is opening her eyes and seeing herself and her world in a brand new way by that light. And Simon is saying, shut the windows, give me my mask, don't force me to have to look at this light. Simon does not want to look at the truth of who he is. And he avoids doing so. But the woman looks at the mercy of forgiveness. And she knows who she is. And she knows she needs forgiveness. You see, the moralist or the legalist in religious matters will always look at the wrong thing. He will always first look at the behavior. Now, I'm not getting you off the hook and saying any wrong behavior is okay. No, don't say that. I've already drawn a very, very important connection between outward behavior and inward heart. The issue, though, is not the outward behavior per se. It is what does it say about the heart? This woman was an adulterer. This woman was a sexual sinner. Does Jesus ignore her sexual sin? Does he say it does not matter? No, he just drives the question deeper. He says, what does her sin mean? And that, my dear friend, is the critical issue for every one of us dealing with our sin. Look at the sin, but don't just stay looking at it on the surface. Ask the question, what does my sin mean? Drive it to the issue of the heart. For only at that level will it be solved. You see, if you don't drive it to the heart, then you remain on the level of the one who thinks, all I need to do is fix my behavior. That's what Simon says. Simon says, be good. And he looks at the sin. The woman says, I'm not good. And she looks at forgiveness. And that makes all the difference in the world. I love the culture of Japan. As many of you know, I've been there 8 or 9 times. I think it's a marvelously fascinating country. It's a country that has been very resistant to the gospel. And one of the reasons why the gospel of grace, of forgiveness, has not penetrated the Japanese culture is because it is one of the most legalistic cultures on the face of the planet. You all know that when you go to a Japanese home, you have to take off your shoes in the foyer. What you may not know is that you cross from the foyer into the main part of the home, you are required to bring a gift. That's why there's a lot of conversation around the doors of Japanese homes, because if you cross beyond the foyer, then you must give a gift as you enter. Must. Do. Do it right. Japanese people are famous for doing it right. One time I was in Tokyo and I bought an ice cream cone and I started walking down the street with my ice cream cone. And everyone stared at me because that was not doing it right. In Japan, it's just the custom that you never walk and eat at the same time. It's considered impolite. Well, when I learned that, I stopped and sat down and ate my ice cream cone so I wouldn't offend the people. But the point is we all have our rules, don't we? We all have our definition of what is right and wrong. And the passage forces you to answer the question, are you a Pharisee or are you forgiven? It forces you to answer that question. Which one of these people do you identify with? The moralist who lives by his judgment or the sinner who lives in her forgiveness? Now be thoughtful as you answer. Don't be too quick to answer. You see, many of us start our Christian lives with great exuberance. We're so excited when we become Christians, perhaps as a teenager or something. We're thrilled, and we seek to honor the Lord, and we're excited, and we're eager. We may not always be thoughtful, but what we lack in thoughtfulness, we make up in warmth and genuineness, and we are lavish in our worship. We're delighted to praise the Lord. I'll never forget a young man in my church in Charlottesville who was in a wheelchair with cerebral palsy. And he would always sit front and center in the wheelchair right here. I grew up in that wheelchair before my very eyes, Sunday by Sunday. Martin was his name. And Martin was a little bit delayed in his responses, but he loved Jesus and he loved the Word. And sometimes when a great thing would happen up front, or somebody would sing a song that he liked, or there was something that happened that he just wanted to approve of, he would yell, "Wow!" The problem was his wow was about 15 seconds after the event was all over and everyone else had forgotten about it. But it didn't really matter, did it? Because we all knew what was meant by Martin's wow. He was exuberant in his worship. But over time, what happens to us? We become more careful, more calculated. Some of us in ministry, in fact, get very professional about things. You know, we just say the right thing, do the right thing, part our hair down the middle so we don't offend anybody in the church. That's what ministers are good at doing, right? And tragically, forgiveness becomes something that is professionally administered. In contrast with being an amateur, the word amateur comes from the Latin amatori, which means to love something. And you know what? When it comes to forgiveness, we're all amateurs, and we're all to remain amateurs our whole life long. You are to love being loved by Jesus in the gospel. How easily we slide into being legalists. My way of doing it. My way of understanding the church. My way of setting the rules. My way of determining what is right or wrong. I'll give you an example. It involves teenagers. We talked about teenagers earlier. Do I care about kids drinking? Yes, I do. Do I think it's right for parents to serve alcohol to kids in their homes? No, I do not, underage kids. Do I think that kids underage should be drinking? No, I do not. But you know what I also believe? You don't get saved by not drinking. And you know what? For some reason in this community, as maybe because it has been an important issue, and maybe because some people have lost their lives, as they have in most communities, many of us Christians have elevated that issue to some incredible standard of importance. You know what? It isn't. The deeper thing is, what is going on in the heart of a child who drinks when his parents say don't? What is going on in the heart of a child who will allow himself to receive alcohol when he knows he shouldn't? Those are the issues, and that's the way we need to drive it. Not the externals, but the internals. You know, our problem today is that we don't know how to talk about sin. We think of sin as all these external things, and therefore we tend more and more in our culture to minimize them because we can't bear the reality of how bad sin is, so we minimize the external things. Do you know what that produces? It produces a culture that we live in now where when you publicly speak of the awfulness of sin, most of the time you're talking about desserts. You heard me, desserts. A peanut butter binge. Oh, that's sinful. Chocolate challenge. Or sinful strawberry delight. We don't know how to talk about it anymore. One writer that I'm reading currently says that recalling and confessing sin is like taking out the garbage. Once is not enough. And that's another way of saying what we frequently say around here, which is we must preach the gospel to ourselves every day. And part of preaching the gospel to ourselves about the gospel, the forgiveness, is preaching the gospel to ourselves about sin, that sin is really sin. It isn't the superficial things. It isn't the what are called by the Puritans the cool sins of pride and ambition? What about the warm sins that fill our hearts that we don't talk about anymore? And yet, actually, we must remember that if we don't talk about sin, we have no basis for talking about forgiveness. Sin is real. The question is, it's much more real than you think it is, because it isn't just the external thing. It's the internal heart. And that's where the question must be driven. That's where we must take it all the time. Where sin is concerned, the writer that I'm reading currently says, where sin is concerned, people just mumble now. The moralist is always looking for a way to mumble about sin, to minimize it, to shift the blame, to externalize the behavior into endless trivial behaviors, and never to deal with it as a matter of the heart. But the sinner who lives in her forgiveness learns to delight in her forgiveness, never to minimize her sin, but to see the honest recognition of what is going on in her heart as the stepping stone toward understanding the transforming power of the forgiveness of the gospel. The assumptions of previous generation about sin and forgiveness was that you couldn't understand either without understanding both. Today, many people want the forgiveness, but they don't want to talk about what's going on in their hearts. Or they want to talk about superficial things, as if all we have to do is clean up the party scene on Saturday night in our community. That's not it. That's not where the garbage needs to be taken out. Here's where the garbage needs to be taken out. And that's where we must start. The best a moralist can do is to measure out forgiveness very carefully. You do this, you say this, I'll give you this amount of forgiveness. That's the best a moralist can do. And it doesn't lead to the lavishness, the sheer lavishness of what is going on in this passage, much less does it lead to tears, to hair, to feet, to perfume. The key is really in verse 42. In the story that Jesus tells the Pharisee, he says, when they could not pay, he canceled their debt. When they could not pay. The problem with us is that we think we can pay. Subtly. Oh, I mean, not out. You know, we don't say that directly. We believe that Jesus died for our sins. But us good Christian people, we really believe that I can pay God off and that I should pay God off for what he's done for me. So I'm constantly looking for a way to fulfill the obligation that forgiveness gives me. Hear me. The only obligation forgiveness places upon you is to live in its lavishness. Barbara and I visited the Grand Teton Mountains this summer. They're beautiful. Never seen them before. They were just gorgeous. Wonderful, beautiful. What obligation did the Grand Teton Mountains put upon me? Just to relish their beauty. That's all. John Piper tells this story about a fountain, amazing fountain of just crystal clear water. A man is very thirsty. He comes to that fountain. He drinks his fill. And he goes away and he goes to a little mud puddle down the street. And he takes a little pile of water from the mud puddle and he takes it back to the fountain and says, here, fountain, let me replace the water that I took from you. That's what we do. That's what we do with God all the time. Here, God, you gave me forgiveness. Now I'm going to do a good thing for you. Can you imagine the laughter God the Father and God the Son are having at our attempts to fulfill the obligation that we think their lavish forgiveness incurs upon us? The purifying power of forgiveness, the perplexity of forgiveness, and finally, and I'll just be quite brief, very, very brief, the passion of forgiveness. I use this word passionately, deliberately, but carefully. The woman's response to Jesus is sometimes confused with passion of a different sort, isn't it? Especially when she starts letting down her hair, and especially when she starts kissing his feet. But let me tell you something. This is on almost all certainty the first time in her adult life that this woman has ever chastely touched a man. And the response, you see, is going to be lavish on her part. If you were listening carefully a moment ago when I said that the only obligation that forgiveness creates is that we live in it, you probably should have had some bell go off in your head. Something like this. Wait a minute, Skip. What about the places in the Bible where it says I'm supposed to take up my cross and follow Jesus? What about the places where it says I'm supposed to do good and not do evil, or obey the commandments, or all those places where I'm told to do something? Aren't those things I'm supposed to do? Yes. Yes. But only after you have received the lavishness of forgiveness. Only when you relish and live in and wallow in the lavishness of forgiveness so much that you know there is no thing you can do to repay the Lord for it. And if you try, you are being theologically stupid. This woman, once she understands it, lavishly gives to the Lord, doesn't she? She takes his perfume, which was her life savings, and pours it all out wastefully. And here I make a link to the message last week, frankly, beyond the tithe, which you owe to Christ's kingdom and his work. I don't know how much you should give, but I do know that the more you have been impressed inwardly with the wonder of forgiveness, the more you will want to give. And that the measure in some ways of your understanding of the transforming power of the forgiveness of Christ in the gospel is in your checkbook. So there's lavish giving, but there's also risky serving. Coming into Simon's dining room was not culturally unacceptable for a person to do. I've already told you that. But for this woman, it was very, very risky. Things could get ugly. They could stone her. When moralism sees forgiveness, it sometimes turns mean. Moralism hates forgiveness, because it means it's out of my control. There's nothing I can do. I can't do a good deed that's going to get the Lord to like me. Things can go wrong at dinner parties when the guest list isn't put together very carefully. But forgiveness always makes its own welcome at the table. It transcends the lines, the distinctions that the moralist wants to draw are erased by the forgiveness of the gospel. And those distinctions that the moralist wants to draw are not just about your behavior, but about who's acceptable at your dinner party. Who's invited into your church? Who can come into your fellowship, your association, your group? And you know what? We're a lot more moralistic than we think. The forgiveness of the gospel shatters our social routines, and it makes us throw parties for those who have never been invited before, because they are our brothers and sisters in Christ. When we are forgiven, we are transformed by that forgiveness. And the degree of transformation depends on the depth and extent of our grasp of the forgiveness that's given. The purifying power of forgiveness, the perplexity of forgiveness, the passion of forgiveness. And oh yes, there is one more, the very end, the very last words. The peace of forgiveness. That's why Jesus can say, go in peace. And he doesn't just mean peace, peace that comes on the dew of the springtime morning. He doesn't mean the peace of the mountains or the peace of the seashore. He means the peace of the gospel. The peace that he means when he says, therefore, having just been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Do you have that peace? Do you know that kind of peace with God? Do you know the power of forgiveness in your heart and life? Then go in peace. And if you don't know the power of forgiveness and the peace that comes along with it, don't leave until you get it. For nothing else really matters. Amen.